This is talking with Michael Ovenen on 1st September 76 at Grenoble. So can you tell me when you first were at Jodrell and how that happened and so forth?
Oh yeah, my first... I went to Jodrell Bank in the summer of 1946. I was an undergraduate at London University then, but I had in fact been a member of a group of amateur astronomers who observed meteors, because in those days that visual observation was the only way of observing them. And what had happened was that at Jodrell Bank, as I think you know, they started by attempting with very small radar sets to observe cosmic ray bursts in the atmosphere. And they got echoes, but they weren't cosmic ray bursts, and the question was whether they were meteors. And so I went to Jodrell Bank in that summer to observe meteors and to correlate them with the observed radio echoes, which I think was satisfactorily done. I mean, I was not an author of a paper, I was just a member of a group.
Right.
The paper itself was actually written by Lovell and Prentice.
But you were hired by them, essentially.
Well, I actually did kind of honor for them, yeah.
Oh.
I mean,
So what was the setup there? I mean,
was interesting. It was basically an army radar hut in a field and a generator. And one used to go out from Wilmslow, which is a suburb of Manchester, I remember in Lovell's car, we used to live every evening. Because, of course, I was observed, interested only at night because I was looking at the visual trails of the meteors. One interesting thing, of course, is that Jodrell Bank is now famous for astronomy. I don't know what Jodrell himself would have thought about it, because Jodrell was interested in biology. He's a Jodrell Professor of Biology at the University of London. And Jodrell Bank then was, as it still indeed is, was an agricultural, botanical research station.
Right.
And just a little portion of it was taken for radio astronomy.
Well,
but now it's grown to...
Oh, I didn't realize that. I knew it was a botany station, but the name itself is named after...
Named after Jodrell, who was a man who left money for all over the place.
I thought it was a local village or something.
No, no, it's actually named after... To the best of my knowledge, otherwise it's an extraordinary coincidence, because who is a Jodrell professor?
And where does the bank come from?
Oh, I guess that's just bank, the slope.
Okay.
But I'm sure Sir Bernard Lovell could correct me if I'm wrong there, but I think that's the origin.
What about the... these radar echoes, were you skeptical of this, or was it pretty clear that they were...
Oh, no, in fact, it was almost clear, I think, by the time I went there that it was. One of the problems which I recall, mind you remember this is many years ago, one of the problems I recall was a certain class of persistent echo, which seemed to last much longer than the meteor trail.
Mm-hmm.
I think it turned out they were associated with meteors. No, it was pretty well certain by the time I went there, I think, they were actually meteors. And indeed, as I recall, the period I had there was to a considerable extent cloudy, as a result of which I spent most of my time watching the radar screen rather than the sky. But that was my first introduction to Jodrell Bank, and I must say I have watched as an outsider, so to speak, its growth with considerable interest.
Right. Then you were trained as an optical astronomer?
Well, no, I was trained as a physicist, of course, because I went to, trained in the sense that I did a physics degree, and of course I went to college during the war, and one had to do this. Astronomy as a subject at the university didn't exist during the war. In fact, I spent my first year in Cambridge, my colleague was evacuated there, and I did spend a lot of time at the observatories.
Can I just ask you a question
there? Yeah. But what I'm trying to get at is you in Science Progress in particular wrote several reviews over the next 15 years, and you were doing this as, what were you mainly working on yourself at that time?
My main work at that time, but this time I'd gone to Cambridge. I was at the staff of the observatories there as an optical astronomer. And my main work was at that time concerned with solar flares on the one hand and photometry of stars on the other. The solar flares had a direct connection with radio astronomy in that, at least with radar astronomy, which in those days was not very clearly separated. I mean, even what I referred to just now as radio astronomy in Manchester was radar astronomy.
Right.
It was from that the radio astronomy began. I did, in fact, work together with Juan Bracewell, who's since become a very well-known radio astronomer at Stanford, on the effect of solar flares, which I was observing optically in the H-alpha line and the observatories, with the height of the D layer of the ionosphere, which was being observed by radar. And that was work that I did in Cambridge.
And Bracewell was doing that in Radcliffe's group?
He was doing that in Radcliffe's group.
I see. Okay, well... Now, in the early 50s, as you know, there were very few optical astronomers. It really took much I'd be interested in your comments on...
Yes, I have two comments on it. First of all, I think you have to remember that there was a generation gap, a very obvious one, in astronomy, among optical astronomers, in that optical astronomy substantially had a complete break during the war. So what happened after the war was there were some senior optical astronomers who came back to the senior positions, and then there were a lot of young people who'd had no continuity in the past In fact, in one sense, it was very difficult to recruit young optical astronomers. There was no continuity of PhDs, for example. They all stopped during the war. The result of which was, I think, that this, you say there was a lack of interest among optical astronomers. This tended, I think, to be among the more senior people. I mean, myself, for example, one of the first jobs that I had to do outside my direct work at Cambridge was to attempt to correlate the radio positions which were coming from the new radio group in Cambridge,
right, on the Martin Sorrell.
Oh yes, almost before that. Yeah, this is back in 1948-49.
Right.
To try and correlate them with optical objects, and that's how I got to know people like Martin Weil and Graham Smith. The trouble was, of course, and it's not a criticism of the radio astronomers, they would come with an accurate position, which was plus or minus 1 degree.
Right, right.
And they expected that you look on a star chart and you find something.
Now, who was it that put you onto this, to try to do this correlation? Was it they that came over and said...
Oh, yes. I mean, they certainly did come over to the observatory. I mean, there was not a complete break. On the other hand, there was a lack of understanding. For example, I think this is quotable, but you can check with Graham Smith if you like. I mean, Graham Smith, a very good friend of mine now, later on we were joint secretaries of the Royal Astronomical Society, but I remember his coming to me sometime in the 1950s and saying that he had in fact worked out all the formerly spherical trigonometry ab initio for himself, not realising astronomers must have used it.
Right.
So that's the kind of dichotomy.
He told me that himself.
That's right. It's not a lack of sympathy, it was just a complete lack of understanding. And, for example, the radio astronomers in England in those days, they were recruited generally from the ranks of people who were electrical engineers during the war, you see.
Right.
They were publishing in the Institute of Electrical Engineers and so on. And it took quite an effort on the part of some conventional astronomers to get them into feeling themselves to be astronomers. And I don't know whether this has ever been mentioned, because it's not an obvious thing that you would find out from the literature, but in fact Professor McCrae, who is here and was at that time Secretary of the Royal Astronomical Society, played a very great part in seeing the importance of bringing the radio astronomers into the astronomical community.
I see.
And if you haven't talked to him, you might
like
to do so. You'd never find anything in print to this
effect. What exactly did he do?
Well, I mean, as secretary, he went out of his way to say, will you submit your paper? We'll have a meeting on radio astronomy, that kind of thing.
And one can look in observatory and find these early
papers.
You'd
find
indeed.
That, that's right. But it may not be so well realized that it was primarily McCrae who,
that's interesting.
Who did that, you see. And so I think by this was a very important thing in the development of radio astronomy in Britain, because I think at a quite early stage the radio astronomers did begin to feel themselves as part of astronomy. There was still, of course, a very different approach. This lasted for many years.
It still does. Yeah.
Although I think there's been a lot of... I mean, here I think at Grenoble we can see that for the very first time there's some doubts about whether one ought to have a radio astronomy commission.
Right.
There's no longer this feeling, and there's a separation. Indeed, people, shall we say, like Morton Roberts, it's an obvious case in the States, began as an optical astronomer, became a radio astronomer. Jenner, perhaps even more so, you might say.
Harold Weaver,
that's right. So, and there have been a few cases of people going the other way, too. For example, the classic case is Hanbury Brown's optical interferometer.
Right.
Which is a very clear case of radio astronomy techniques
but
mediating
I would optics. Submit, though, I think that may be the only one in the 50s of any note. I'd have to check that.
That's right. I think that the period when I was writing in Science Progress, you have to remember my terms of reference were to cover the whole of astronomy in a quarterly reviews. And there one certainly felt a separation. I mean, one didn't feel opposed to the radio astronomers, but you did not feel part of it. They looked at things in different ways. The nearest we had at the observatories was, in fact, a small ionospheric station under Ian Brown. But radio astronomers, yes, they would come and see us, but there was certainly a little bit of a separation.
Do you think that the separation was largely because the techniques were so different, or the philosophy of the people was so different? Was it impossible to distinguish those two things?
I think it's the generation gap was the substantial point. That is to say, if you look at what was indeed needed in astronomy, maybe in the years between the wars, was a kind of approach which required great rigor in mathematics, great rigor in observations. The way to progress at that time in astronomy, I think, was a great need for accurate proper motions and things like this. But the type of person who will be prepared to take a set of plates, knowing that it'll be 20 years before the second set are taken, is a different kind of animal from the person who's building new equipment, and, like Galileo, looking at the sky.
Yes.
I mean, I look upon it as the Galileo phase, and just as Galileo, of course, ran afoul of some of the conventional astronomers of his day, in the same way, of course, this new spirit, the feeling that nobody had done astronomy, you see, until we came along, which was the feeling that some great astronomers had. That naturally antagonized people who'd been working for 20 or 30 years steadily on the old astronomy.
That's a very good point. Now, can you... David Dewhurst, I guess, is another example of a young astronomer at that time who was very interested in radio.
He was a contemporary of mine. He was also a junior observer.
And I've talked to him.
Yeah.
But can you name some other, in defense of your thesis, that young astronomers people. Were more interested? Of course, Bottom and Kowski were two senior ones in Oort that violate that. But
that's right. Oh, and then there were senior people. Say later on, I'm not sure how soon did Minkowski get on.
Well, as soon as Graham Smith had his acrid positions in 51, he was willing to spend the time with a 200-inch. One arc minute positions is what required.
Okay, you want me to name other names, and that's a little difficult, because you have to remember that the astronomical community in England at the time, which I knew, was very small indeed.
That's true.
Now, I'd like notice of that. Maybe if you let me think a little while, I could maybe drop
When you get the transcript of this, you can add some in.
But I still think that basically that was the division. Mm-hmm. I recently had occasion, for example, to write the obituary notice of a very good friend of mine, Professor Smart, who was an example of the classical astronomer.
Right.
Mathematical rigor, precise observations. I mean, what are they going to think about somebody who comes along and talks about plus or minus 1 degree as an accurate position?
Although,
I mean, you can see the whole philosophy of
different.
They were wrong. I mean, I'm not arguing.
Yeah. Although, do you think that perhaps when... people like Graham Smith publish papers in which they talk about all the possible errors in interferometry and axis of being off and all this. Did the optical astronomers perhaps begin to listen a bit more when they really saw that these people were
trying
to do the absolute best they could?
But you know, I think that, I mean, I don't know how much this directly influenced it, but I can remember very clearly when Graham Smith first met him back in the 40s, saying that sometime or other they'd have to go back and look at what Bessel did. With a transit instrument, because they were going to have to do the same thing.
Yeah.
And so I think, while I don't mean any particular credit to myself, I think it was the contact with optical astronomers that really suggested to them that if only subliminally, that they were going to really have to look at this problem, because originally they didn't. I mean, that's the point. Sometime in there, I suppose, the early 50s, they were really doing a good job on it.
Just the other day, Graham Smith told me that he drived all these things, and then he found out that Bessel hadn't
driven them. That's right.
Well, now, looking more, you've made some very valuable comments already, but looking at the development of the field as a whole in its relation to optical astronomy, do you see any other trends that you might like to comment on?
Oh, I think the thing that came very clearly, of course, out of radio astronomy was, first of all, of course, the emphasis on interstellar matter. I mean, if you look back and realize just how much time is now devoted either to interstellar matter or to things that arise from it, increased knowledge of the problems of star formation and so on. All of this has substantially been the result of radio astronomy. Our emphasis has moved from, as I would put it, things which are almost in thermodynamic equilibrium to conditions very far from thermodynamic equilibrium. That's been a very big shift in our whole approach to astronomy. I think that's one thing. I think also a much greater appreciation of the instability of the universe. I mean, let's think, for example, that I don't know whether you ever saw the program, you may have seen it on public television in America, but the BBC did a program called The Violent Universe.
Yes, I've seen it.
It was, in fact, at the time, I think, a very good program. The point is, this would have been an inconceivable way of approaching astronomy, I think, before the war. Because the axiom was that the things you were dealing with were substantially unchanging, except for a few anomalies.
Mm-hmm.
You knew there were supernovae, but they were the anomaly. What you were really interested in was the great majestic clockwork that went on almost without friction, you see.
Yeah,
think of what's going on here now. All over the place, things are exploding and unstable, and we're talking about things that may even have time scales of fractions of a second. I mean, it's a whole completely different world.
Yeah.
And I'm just, I think, old enough to realize that difference.
Yeah, and the radio, of course, now it's X-rays and everything, but you would say that the radio was just the first and biggest step.
The biggest step towards the
realization, as I say, first of all, of the importance of non-thermodynamic processes in the universe, and secondly, the importance of instabilities, and that things just weren't eternal.
Yeah.
It wasn't an eternal clockwork, it was a really active and dynamic process going all the time. That was what I did write. In fact, you might be interested to refer specifically to this article, my very last article in Science Progress.
What year was it?
Which must have been, I'm just trying to work out, it would probably be 1960. Because I wrote for 11 years, and I think I started in 48, so it'll be around 1960. I did, in fact, do a retrospect of the 11 years that I'd written. I said, how does astronomy look compared with 11 years before? And I think these points would probably be argued.
Yes, I'd like to see that.
And that would be better than my saying now, because I may be looking with also some hindsight, whereas that would be actually what I was feeling
at that time, right. Right. Yeah. Well, I am looking at your individual articles also, right?
That I think, would be my main...
What about the cosmological aspects, log n, log s, 2c?
That, I think, is... this is a... Perhaps here I would want to make a caution. It seems to me that as a result of radio astronomers entering the field, who are, let us put it, more down-to-earth people, perhaps. They've got to build apparatus, or, you know. They have, in fact... This is a personal view which you might not even get all optical astronomers to agree with. I think they have confused cosmology and metagalactic physics. And they are substantially different subjects. Cosmology is avowedly a branch of metaphysics, but I would argue that there is no way to talk about the universe as a whole that does not make explicit some metaphysical view. Metaphysics is implicit in everything you do in the laboratory, but it can be implicit. The moment you start to talk about the universe as a whole, well, as I sometimes put it, just as Harry Truman said about the White House, the buck stops here.
Yeah.
Well, the metaphysical buck stops at cosmology. Now, if you say no, cosmology is simply taking the same physics and doing the metagalaxy with it, instead of the galaxy, I think one is making a mistake. There's nothing wrong in what he's done, but it's kind of writing out as pointless what I think is the only way you'll ultimately do cosmology, which is to look very carefully at metaphysics of it. So in that sense, I feel that maybe we have lost a little bit. We've gained a lot in observations, but we perhaps have lost a little of the humility, which I think is the only way you can really approach cosmology.
Hmm.
Does this make some sense to you?
Well, this of course, is a philosophical point, really.
Right,
right,
I think so.
Right.
And astronomy is the ultimate philosophical pursuit in the end.
I mean, what you're saying is that the ultimate way to get at cosmology is not through observations. Do I have you right?
No, I think the observations are important, but I think the ultimate models you adopt are going to be models that are adopted on grounds that are substantially metaphysical,
right.
If you like, what you call a simple model.
You're kidding yourself if you're saying that the data is really going to speak
for
itself.
That's right. There's no such thing as a fact of observation. There are observations, but even to say what the observations are implies some background of idea.
Right.
And I think one kids oneself if one believes that simply by observing one will understand all these things. It's never happened that way. I mean, even with Galileo, who did an enormous lot with his telescope, what is important about Galileo was the way he thought about the world, not what he saw in his telescope. It's still true. It's what is ultimately Galileo's.
So your comment really is not confined to cosmology.
Oh, not at all. But I mean, I think it's very, very important there. It's where I think you're really involved with this problem that you cannot haul yourself up totally by your own bootstraps in that sort of way.
Yeah.
But you can mislead yourself if you do. And just as if you're near the laboratory, everything's fine. You go out a little way, you wouldn't expect the deviations to be much. The further you go out, the greater the risk. And this really, I think, was one of the things that Phil Myerson was talking about, you see, in his address on the laws of physics. He didn't put it quite that way, but he was saying, okay, we can't take the law of gravitation locally and expect to extend it indefinitely.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. We must always be willing to say there are constraints upon the way we can look at the world that don't arise from our local experience.
Yeah, yeah. Why exactly is it that radio astronomy, in your opinion, got off this track? Because these people were engineers?
I think, first of all, it's because their background... I mean, to be a radio astronomer, I think I might say, there may be now some people who are... in radio astronomy observatories who are perhaps theoretical astrophysicists. But basically, a radio astronomer is still a guy who makes some new equipment.
Mm-hmm.
He decides what he has to do with it. And he has to be a man who can make a piece of apparatus work. And that does not usually go with what you would call an inclination to profound philosophy. Or even inclination to philosophy at all.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point.
And why it's particularly important, because of course, while the whole status of quasars is still uncertain, it is really true that it's the radio astronomer who looks furthest. It's the radio astronomer who is really giving us the information upon which our cosmology should be founded. That, I want to make clear, I think that's true.
Right.
But it's the way of approaching it, I think, that is not really...
But then...
but that's...
But what you're saying is that then when he then goes on as naturally one wants to do and tries to interpret his stuff, it might be better if he left that to one with a more metaphysical outlook.
Well, I mean...
Or got himself trained in that.
Yeah, well, I think it's just that one has to be just a little bit, have a little bit more humility.
Yeah.
I don't mean that in a critical way. I mean, I just think to realize that it's very difficult to formulate what you mean by an understanding when you're dealing with the universe as a whole. And don't just sort of go on like a bull in a china shop expecting that local ideas are going to be all you need.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it needs more than that. And of course, exactly what happens at places like the Knob. I mean, I'm very impressed at this meeting here. It seems to me there has been much more interchange. We have not had a Radio Astronomy Commission holding, I don't know how many meetings apart from anybody else. There's been a real...
Right.
I felt there's been a good meeting that way.
Right.
And I think really talking to many of my radio astronomy friends, that really this is now their feeling. Long last, and it's only just about now, they're really now feeling integrated as astronomers.
Completely.
They're beginning to feel themselves as astronomers and not physicists
right.
doing
it's
astronomy.
It's taken 30 years, essentially.
I think it's taken 30 years, but I think that's true.
And when would you say that it began, or was that at the 50% point? I mean, that's a very difficult thing to say, but can you give me some feel for that, in your opinion?
I suppose the early 1960s. I mean, I'm thinking... Of course, I take a particular view because I was involved in Cambridge. I'm thinking of what you well know, I'm sure, the arguments between Weil and Hoyle on the significance of the early counts. I expect you know something
right.
of that story.
Oh, yes.
Well, it was unfortunate that I think in that case the radio astronomers were actually wrong at that particular time.
Well, this is now, but this is late 50s. Now,
that's right. That's right, late 50s. I think there you could still see the real friction. And perhaps it still exists in a slight way. I don't know where... At the Cambridge meeting, for example, on cosmology, somebody was writing up, Jeff Burbidge was writing up a list of objects about whether you knew they were cosmological, and there was questions about some of them. And Martin Ryle more or less made the comment that one could, in fact, do cosmology. Were you there?
Yes.
Could do cosmology. You know, well, I mean, that indicates...
Well, could you just say what it was for the record here?
Pardon?
Could you say what it was for the record?
Well, as far as I recall it, though I'm sure he would be willing to say it again, it was to the effect that one radio astronomers could have done cosmology if there'd never been optical astronomy. In a limited sense, of course, is true, but just as the optical astronomer's cosmology was impoverished because they didn't have the radio part of the spectrum, the converse would, of course, equally well have been true.
Right.
But perhaps that's indicative that, see, among what you might call... See, there's a kind of old guard conservative radio astronomer.
right.
I mean, it's the same generation story coming up again. It's the very young radio astronomers who feel themselves, I think, as astronomers.
Yeah, that's right.
They want the people who are more involved with the direct development of it maybe still feel themselves as kind of engineers working in astronomers.
Now, what about solar physics? That's not exactly my field, so I don't feel as comfortable trying to document that. You were in that yourself optically.
Yes.
What would you say is the main things that radio has really done to change solar physics? Especially before 1960.
Yeah. Oh, I think the crucial thing, of course, I suppose, is the... Of which there were hints before, let's face this, but which one didn't come face to face with, was substantially the fact that corona was hot. That you wouldn't, again, it's the same story. The non-thermodynamic equilibrium processes in the corona, how did they interface with the nice, respectable thermodynamic processes
right.
in the photosphere? Now, of course, I was interested in solar flares, which were exactly at this interface. And so I would say the great advance that radio astronomy made was to make us look at this whole question of the outer layers of the sun, which involves, of course, also the solar wind, which, while not by any means confined to radio astronomy, was very much influenced by radio astronomers. The general processes that go on in interfacing a star with empty space.
Yeah. Can you just outline exactly how you think radio astronomy interacted with the solar wind or vice versa?
Oh. Well, I think just as I was saying, the fact that one was forced to look... Well, one way, obviously, radio bursts that we see coming from the sun are produced by particles moving out through the corona. So you may think of those as gusts in the solar wind, if you like. But one was certainly looking in a very direct way, in a way that one could not do optically. See, if you look at a prominence optically, you don't really know what... All you see is a region of excitation, but you don't really know what... You don't really know if it's matter that's somehow actually moving out. But with a radio burst, you can actually detect the passage outwards of the disturbance.
You can't do that? You can't see a prominence move up and measure
velocities?
Yes,
you can, but you're not sure...
it's difficult to measure the velocity. Well, you can measure the velocity in prominence, but the problem is that you don't know whether what you're looking at is an area of excitation that's changing. You're not quite sure whether the particles are moving out.
Yes.
Whereas I think I'm sure, I mean, perhaps it's not so clear cut I'm trying to make it. Seems to me that it was with the radio observations of bursts through the corona that we had first really definite evidence of actual motion of particles at quite high speeds out through the corona. Because we were using the invisible corona, visible optically, as a kind of chalkboard to watch the particles moving out.
But now, so you're saying it's sort of natural then that there was material going further, and of course there were correlations between geomagnetic.
That's right, and then one began to look more, and then one began, and even I mean, much of the detection of solar winds still depends on radio techniques, although it finally came to its apotheosis, of course, with satellite.
I'd just like to get this straight. The solar wind was suggested, I think, by Biermann in the early 50s, based on comets.
That's right.
Primarily. And its first real detection was with Mariner 2 or something like this, back in the early 60s.
My point is, I think that that what the radio astronomers did was to make the climate such that Biermann would make such a suggestion. I mean, you imagine if you tried to think back to the 1930s. I mean, space was almost by definition supposed to be empty. And so you naturally thought that if you see something coming from the sun, I mean, the tail of a comet related to the sun, it must be light pressure.
Yeah, that's the only thing that was there.
That's right. Whereas somehow or other, let's take even the simplest thing. Optically, you see the sun and it's half a degree. You stick your radio telescope up, it's 2 degrees. Well, I mean, you immediately start to say, what's in that space?
Yeah, right.
You begin to think of that space as an active physical area, arena. In the 30s, you didn't. You automatically thought of it as empty.
Could you say that again?
I say you automatically thought space as being empty in the 30s. You knew, for example, that there was not enough resistance to affect the motion of the planets significantly, so you said, okay, it's empty. These are psychological things, but I think they're very important.
Oh, yeah, they're extremely important. Now, I'm a little confused as to really what the attitude was during World War II, and there wasn't much research going on, but anyway, pre-war work on the existence of a corona. The lines had been identified by Edlin, I think.
Yes.
But how well accepted was it that there was this hot, that the corona was extremely hot? And how important was the very first radio observations of a million kelvins in pinning this down?
Well, my impression is, but you remember, I only came into this just about the time, I suppose, when the radio observations were becoming known, which is the late 40s. My impression is that it had not been fully accepted that there was a corona which had important things going on at a very high temperature. I mean, there was a corona yesterday. It was, I think it's not so much, again, I come back to the psychological point, it's not so much that people didn't know in the literature there was some evidence that the corona was hot. But since you only saw the corona at the time of an eclipse, most times you could forget about it.
Yeah.
Well, you stick your radio telescope up and the 2 degrees are there all the time.
Right.
And that's the point. The corona became something people were interested in.
Yes.
Instead of being a marginal thing.
Yeah.
The radio astronomers looking at the sun, that was their interest. They couldn't care a jot about the photosphere. And so they gave the urge and the push to start discussing. I mean, if you look back, when did Hoyle write his, it's a controversial book, but when did Hoyle write his book on solar physics? Somewhere in about 1950.
48 or 9, I think.
Maybe somewhere around about there, as I recall. And there, of course, that is one of the important topics of discussion. Exactly at the time when the radio observations were becoming known, you see, because after all, the corona was observed during the war. It's just after the war, the information
Now, you mentioned briefly the business of trouble with radio source identifications when the very first positions were off by a degree or two, and then, of course, they got a couple to a few arc minutes and a couple of identifications, but still most sources, the weaker ones, were off by half a degree, 10, 20 arc minutes. And still, by the late 50s, there were only 20, 30 identifications or so. Can you comment on it seems to me this must have been very frustrating to the optical observers who, even those who are interested, they might just throw up their hands and say, well, it's hopeless. And especially when Mills' catalog disagreed with Ryle's, he said, was there an attitude, well, boys, go in the corner and get yourself straightened out, and then come to us with positions? Or what?
Yes, I think there was. I mean, I think that was my... What I did was substantially to look at all the objects for which there would be very few per square degree and see if they correlated, which they didn't.
What sort of objects, just out of curiosity?
Bright extragalactic nebulae, for example. And of course, they didn't correlate because even the nearest nebulae was a fairly faint radio source by the standards of the 1950s.
Right.
I did look at flare stars, or at least they weren't really recognized quite as fast as, but the EME.
You're talking about 49 or so now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You probably looked at Bright Stars also.
Oh, you looked at Bright Stars, because nothing happened.
Right.
Oh, yes, yeah, sure, that was the first thing one looked at. And so what I said was, it's useless to try and do a correlation unless I can find some class of object which is sufficiently rare that you only get
right.
about one in each box, or even less than that.
Did you have any idea? Did you come back and say to them what sort of positional accuracy they'd have to have before they could really probably do the job right? That you could do the optical identification right?
Well, I don't know why you asked that question, because all I said was simply that it seemed to me there was no way of identifying at the precision with which the positions
yeah.
were currently given. But until you knew what the objects were, it would be difficult to know, actually.
Yeah, okay.
And you've got to remember, it's a very interesting thing back in those days, which you're probably aware, but it became apparent that the radio sources were more or less isotropically distributed. And even the radio astronomers themselves, never occurred to them that the objects could be, in fact, extragalactic. And they were talking, I can remember going to a lecture by Ryan, it must have been about 1950, in the Physical Society, where he was quite confident that the sources were very close because they were isotropically distributed. They were even, not wholly humorously, talking about the possibility they might even be radio transmissions from other planets, I mean, or something, to try and get some idea of how you could have so many things within a few parsecs.
You mean, what do you mean planets? I don't follow.
Oh, no, the idea they were actually radio transmissions from inhabited beings on planets of other stars.
Who was talking? I've never seen any reference to that written down anyway.
I thought it was, certainly was mentioned in the lecture. Are you sure it's not in Ryle's thing in the Proceedings of the Physical Society? Not the Proceedings.
You mean the Reports in Progress in Physics?
Right,
he had a huge review in 1950.
Right. You sure it isn't mentioned now? It was mentioned in the lecture. Half humorously.
Yes.
I mean, it was thrown out as a humorous remark. Nevertheless, there were real problems at understanding...
In the light of what's going on in the last few years, of course, it's rather interesting.
That's
though.
Right. But the interesting thing was, the automatic assumption was that these objects must be very near because they're isotropic. Nobody had the courage to suggest that they're extragalactic. And I'm trying to recall, I suppose it must have been...
Well,
Cygnus A, that the first real,
first
real suggestion suddenly,
yes,
was probably Tommy
right.
Gold.
Well, but even then, Ryle hung on to the radio stars for a couple of years afterwards, but then Gold began talking that... To him, much more obvious that
that's
they were extragalactic.
Right.
And there
that's
were
right.
some interesting things in observatory you can read
that's right.
Between the two.
And the switch happened, I think, then fairly quickly, somehow.
But can you sort of give an impression of what the attitude was in the even in the late 50s? The positions were getting down to 10, 20 arc minutes, but still the identifications were not coming in the optical community. They're sort of giving up hope that... It was just an entirely different universe that these people were seeing, and the correlation coefficient was bound to remain zero, or?
That's an interesting question, because, I mean, it's very difficult for me to really think back, and, yes, I think the old guard, if you like, of optical astronomers still were probably skeptical. I think the younger people said, okay, here's something very interesting, obviously this must be important to astronomy. But if one was an optical astronomer, until one had an identification so that one could take one spectrograph and look at it, there wasn't much one could do. I mean, one simply had to say, yes, it's interesting, we like to know what's going on.
Yeah.
And we hope that sometime or other something interesting will be identified so we can get in with you and, and work on it.
Yeah.
But I think, let me put it this way, I think there are very few young optical astronomers in those days who would have contemplated at that stage switching to radio astronomy as being the sort of astronomy of the future.
Yeah.
I think that they would have still thought of it, and this is about to me the point you want you to say. I still think, looking back on it, in the early 50s, probably what we're talking about, early 50s, would still have looked upon radio astronomy as substantially a small part of astronomy, not as a whole new opening of the world.
And in terms of manpower,
but
it was.
That's right. But I think, you know, in a way, I'm not suggesting you do all this extra work, in a way you'd probably find more of my opinion at the time if you read the Science Progress articles than I can now recapture.
Although you probably didn't wax so philosophical in those articles.
Possibly not. But I mean, to give you that kind of idea. The fact that I, as an optical astronomer, what I thought was important to put in the Science Progress article is just that of itself, I think.
Yes, that's true.
Indicative of my own view.
Yeah, true. Now, we've discussed about every aspect. The only one I can think of that we haven't is the whole background radiation.
We haven't discussed the galactic coordinates yet, which I think is interesting.
Oh, okay.
You may think that's unimportant. But
galactic coordinates, yes, tell me.
Well, this was something about which I felt that where the astronomers made a mistake and they're now regretting it. They were very worried apparently by the fact that the zero of galactic longitude didn't point to the centre of the galaxy.
Right.
Okay. Now, the definition, which apparently is quite unknown as far as I could see to radio astronomers, and going back to the Moscow AAU meeting, the actual definition was given by Bessel as the intersection of two great circles, the plane of the galaxy, I suppose it was Bessel anyway, about that time, the plane of the galaxy and the plane of the equator. And it was done for a very definite reason. That definition can be made as accurate as you like as you improve the precision of your observations. But the radio astronomers wanted to have the zero of longitude Sagittarius A. Now that's utter disaster, because that means every single longitude depends on measurements of one object, which in any case might not be the centre of the galaxy.
Yeah.
And a compromise was made in which the zero of longitude was defined as a great circle arising at a certain position angle of the pole in the year 1960, which is a terrible definition because you can't realise the pole of the year 1960. Any time after 1960.
Yeah.
What they should have done was very simple, and I suggested, and I still don't know why they didn't accept it, was simply accept the old definition and add a conventional precession term, so that to the accuracy with which it matters to students, the zero was in the direction of the centre. But you couldn't assume it was definitely so. And in fact, I think it was yesterday, in a discussion of non-circular motion in the galaxy, the question came up whether the dynamical centre of the galaxy was at zero longitude. See, the irony of it is that radio astronomers are now measuring positions more accurately than optical astronomers with long baseline interferometry. And I think that really it was just an unfortunate thing that they didn't realise, they had no experience of accurate position work.
Right.
They didn't realise what was at issue.
Yeah, yeah.
And they basically forced through what I think was a bad thing.
Well, it's rather interesting that they had enough power in the IAU by 1958 force something through.
Right.
I mean, that indicates having come to a certain level.
That's right. Well, in fact, it was the subsequent meeting. The Moscow meeting was where the discussion was.
Right.
I suppose it was presumably the Berkeley meeting. I'm just thinking about the actual decision.
I've never heard anyone talk about this discussion. Was it a sort of a general optical camp versus a general radio camp?
No, not at all. And of course, don't misunderstand me here. I mean, the radio astronomers do a very good job in getting an accurate measurement of the plane. They can measure the plane much more accurately than the astronomers can. No, I don't think so. I think basically, in fact, it wasn't so much the optical astronomers. Those people who had some contact with positional astronomy was more the point.
Yeah.
I mean, I at that time, because I've been in Glasgow for some years, we're under W.M. Smart, and it was interested in positional astronomy. I perhaps was more sensitive than
sure.
people.
Sure, I'm sure you were, yeah.
But I still think that the position was great. Anyway, you can read all about that also in South Korea's articles. Had long discussions afterwards with Pawsey in particular. And I think he saw my point. I mean, basically what they ultimately did was to do what is equivalent. They say, let's realise the pole in 1960 by a conventional backwards interpolation formula. But it was silly to have changed the definition in the first place.
Yeah.
If they're going to do that, they could have just shoved that.
Yeah.
And term in the old definition.
What did Pawsey say when you discussed this
with him? Oh, I think he understood it. I mean, I've got a lot of correspondence with him. I think he did understand what I meant. I think what he said was ultimately what he decided was equivalent. I think that's right. It ultimately was. But it was kind of a roundabout way of arriving at what was really a very simple problem. However, it's quite
okay.
Just indicates how the philosophy was different. And what the irony of it is, I say that who would have believed, I would never have believed, that the radio astronomers would measure positions more accurately.
The thing that you were complaining about.
That's right, exactly.
Now we can do it better.
That's right. I wouldn't believe
that. You mentioned about interstellar matter, the emphasis on that, but the galactic background is a specific case of this, which, of course, is still being discussed on galactic structure, where there's a halo and such. Do you have any comments on?
Are you talking about the background radiation in the galaxy?
Yes, right. And how it was distributed, what its origin was.
Well, okay, yes, that then brings us, I suppose, to the other point. Again, I'm talking generalities, which is the... I think this is perhaps in some ways less significant than the non-equilibrium problems, but that is the significance of electromagnetic forces in astronomy, which, after all, played almost no part in the old astronomy. Whereas presumably it has a part to play in the background radiation. It must have a magnetic field, I would assume, reduce the radiation from the electrons that are spiraling around and so on.
But it's still the same category of non-thermal processes.
Oh yes, indeed, very much so, but that's absolutely right, it's a special case of it.
But
I think that's really what I'd like to comment on, that I really haven't followed this enough to. No, I mean, there is a very interesting question in stellar dynamics about whether there's any dynamical evidence for a large halo mass. And my own view is tentatively that there isn't, but it's not a very strong view.
Well, the whole
I only have rather little to say, I think, about
the whole business of a halo. Of course, Bada had his population too.
Yeah.
And I guess it's fair to say that this was a halo, right?
Oh, I think
and,
so.
And the radio halo was really saying that there was a population 2 component in the non-thermal radio radiation.
Yeah.
So that wasn't really a new idea in itself.
No, that's right. I think what's important is the question of having attention directed to electromagnetic forces in the halo as it now exists. While in energy content, I suspect they're not important. I don't know. It's very difficult to be quite sure what the total energy content is. Maybe they are significant compared to other energy sources. But I think it makes one, again, look at the problem of the condensation of a galaxy with a broader viewpoint and be prepared to admit that at certain stages in the development, electromagnetic forces may be quite important.
Yeah.
I think what it does is broaden the framework in which one discusses these questions. It's the same as you said before. But in a specific detail, I wouldn't wish to comment. It's not really... Okay. I mean, things have got very specialized now. It's really my feeling.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. I say the conventional astronomer, certainly at the end of the last century, and even, I think, into between the wars, tended to be an isolated person, sometimes quite literally. He would be in an observatory miles from anywhere, like Argelander, who made his catalogue by stamping his foot on the floor, and his assistant underneath wrote the time down, and so he made his famous BD chart. Oh, that's how the BD chart was done in 1850, yes. We still use the BD charts now.
Right.
So it attracted the person who was very much an individual worker.
Yep.
Whereas you look right from the beginning of radio astronomy, it was groups of people building
that's
big antennae. So again, you had a different kind of attitude.
Right.
And I don't mean that the conventional astronomer was necessarily antisocial, but there was a sense in which he didn't easily fit into this kind of coffee table discussion. And since I personally tend still, much as I know many radio astronomers, I still tend to be more of an individual worker. I don't sit happily working with a team.
Yeah. Would you argue that the radio astronomers have sort of dragged optical astronomy into this sort of attitude now, or is it still this...
No. I mean, much more in optical astronomy you get... You get the teamwork happening now.
Yeah.
And I don't say that's a bad thing. Perhaps the pendulum has swung a little bit too far. It depends on what time scale you work. I mean, I very much hold the view that the most important things, the most important developments in science, are in fact made in the quietness of somebody's study. I mean, Einstein, Newton, both testify to this, that it was the isolation of quietness. Mm. But not everybody's an Einstein and a Newton.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, obviously, for much of the immediate increase in direct information about the universe, you want the cooperative effort. It's a very interesting question. This I was once asked, I won't say by whom, but by a fairly senior person in the Science Research Council in Britain once, what I attributed the success of optical astronomy in America against the lack of success in Britain. And it is very difficult to nail this down, but I'm sure that part of it was that in America there was more willingness to do things in groups, even optical astronomy.
That the old style just had to give way.
Well, perhaps it had already done so. I mean, the snap answer, of course, is America had big telescopes, but that's only a snap answer. I think what happened was that with the development of big optical telescopes in the States, except for a few notable individuals even now that you can name as well as I, who are still very much for the individualists and recluses, I think even between the wars in America, the idea of cooperative science, perhaps it was something to do with the whole way that America approached the question of industry and everything.
Yeah.
It led to an easier acceptance of the idea of cooperative science.
Yeah.
I think it was true for astronomers between the wars. Other sciences already had met the chemistry, for example, already producing papers where the list of authors is almost as long as the paper.
Yeah.
But not astronomers, no. Between the wars, they were still the person who attracted astronomy as a little bit of a recluse.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
That ends the interview with Ovenden on 1 September 76, and this is the end of the tape.